Pepe and outrun the motorcycle, which couldn't match the T-Bird's top speed of 125. "Hell," he said. Then luck intervened. Screeching around a corner, Billy ran into a flood. Water was gushing out of a drain at the curbside, and the entire width of the road was 2 or 3 inches under. She lost control of her car. The tail of the Thunderbird swung around in a wide arc, and the vehicle spun through a half-circle. Aki veered around her, his bike slipped from under him, and he fell off and rolled in the water, but got up immediately. Anthony jammed on the brakes of the Cadillac and skidded to a halt at the intersection. The Thunderbird came to a halt, slewed across the street, with its trunk an inch from a parked car. Anthony pulled across its front, blocking it in. Billy couldn't get away. Aki was already at the driver's door of the Thunderbird. Anthony ran to the passenger side. "Get out of the car!" he yelled. He drew the gun from his inside pocket. The door opened, and the figure in the black coat and hat got out. Anthony saw, immediately, that it wasn't Luke, but Byrne. He turned and looked back the way they had come. There was no sign of the white Lincoln. Rage boiled up inside him. They had switched coats, and Luke had escaped in Byrne's car. "You fucking idiot!" he screamed at Byrne. He felt like shooting him on the spot. "You don't know what you've done!" Byrne was infuriatingly calm. "Then tell me, Anthony," he said. "What have I done?" Anthony turned away and stuffed the gun back into his coat. "Wait a minute," Byrne said. "You've got some explaining to do. What you did to Luke is illegal." "I don't have to explain one goddamn thing to you," Anthony spat. "Luke's not a spy. How would you know a thing like that?" "I know. I don't believe you." Byrne gave him a hard look. "Sure you do," he said. "You know perfectly well that Luke is not a Soviet agent. So why the hell are you pretending otherwise?" "Go to hell," Anthony said. And he walked away. Billy lived in Arlington, a leafy suburb on the Virginia side of the Potomac River. Anthony drove along her street. As he passed her house, he saw on the other side of the road a dark-colored Chevrolet sedan belonging to the CIA. He turned a corner and parked. Billy would come home in the next couple of hours. She knew where Luke had gone, but she wouldn't tell Anthony. He had lost her trust. She would stay loyal to Luke now, unless Anthony put her under extraordinary pressure. So, that was what he would do. Was he crazy? A small voice in his head kept asking if the race was worth the prize. Was there any justification for what he was about to do? He pushed his doubts aside. He had chosen his destiny long ago, and he was not to be deflected from it, not even by Luke. He opened the trunk of his car and took out a black leather case, the size of a hardcover book, and a pencil flashlight. Then he walked back to the Chevy. He slid into the passenger seat beside Pete and sat looking at the dark windows of Billy's little house. He thought, "This will be the worst thing I have ever done." He looked at Pete. "Do you trust me?" he said. Pete's disfigured face twisted in an embarrassed grin. "What kind of question is that? Yes, I trust you." Most of the young agents hero-worshipped Anthony, but Pete had an extra reason for being loyal to him. Anthony had discovered something about Pete that could get him fired. The fact that he had once been arrested for soliciting a prostitute. But he had kept it secret. Now, to remind Peter that, he said, "If I did something that seemed wrong to you, would you still back me up?" Pete hesitated, and when he spoke, his voice was choked with emotion. "Let me tell you something." He looked ahead through the windscreen at the lamplit street. "You've been like a father to me. That's all. I'm going to do something you won't like. I need you to trust me that it's the right thing to do. I'm telling you, you got it." "I'm going in," Anthony said. "Honk if anyone arrives." He walked softly up the driveway, circled around the garage, and went to the back door. He shone his flashlight through the kitchen window. The familiar table and chairs stood in darkness. He had lived a life of deception and betrayal, but this, he thought with a surge of self-loathing, was the lowest he had ever sunk. The kitchen door had an old-fashioned two-way lock with a key on the inside. Anthony could have opened it with a pencil. He put the flash in his mouth, then unzipped the leather case and took out an instrument like a dental probe. He slid it into the keyhole, pushing the key out on the far side. It fell onto the mat with no sound. He twisted the probe and unlocked the door. Silently, he stepped into the darkened house. He knew his way around. He checked the living room first, then Billy's bedroom. Both were empty. Next, he looked in on Becky Ma. She was fast asleep, her hearing aid on the bedside table. Last, he went into Larry's room. He shone his flash on the sleeping child, feeling sick with guilt. He sat on the edge of the bed and switched on the light. "Hey, Larry, wake up," he said. "Come on." The boy's eyes opened. After a disoriented moment, he grinned. "Uncle Anthony," he said, and he smiled. "Time to get up," Anthony said. "What time is it?"
"It's early."
"What are we going to do?"
"It's a surprise," Anthony said.
4:30 a.m. Fuel shoots into the combustion chamber of a rocket engine at a speed of about 100 feet per second. Burning begins the instant the fluids meet. The heat of the flame soon evaporates the liquids, pressure rises to several hundred pounds per square inch, and the temperature soars to 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Byrne said to Billy,
"You're in love with Luke, aren't you?"
They were sitting in her car outside his building. She didn't want to go in. She was impatient to get home to Larry and Becky Ma.
"In love?" she said evasively. "Am I?"
She wasn't sure how much she wanted to share with her ex-husband. They were friends, but not intimate.
"It's okay," he said. "I realized long ago that you should have married Luke. I don't think you ever stopped loving him. You loved me, too, but in a different way."
That was true. Her love for Byrne was a gentle, calm feeling. With him, she had never felt the hurricane of passion that engulfed her when she was with Luke. And when she asked herself what she felt for Harold, the easy affection or the whirlwind of excitement, the answer was depressingly obvious. Thinking about Harold gave her a pleasant but mild sense of pleasure. She had little experience of men. The only ones she had slept with were Luke and Byrne. But instinct told her that with Harold, she would never have the feeling Luke gave her of a sexual craving that left her weak and helpless with desire.
"Luke's married," she said, "to a beautiful woman."
She thought for a moment.
"Is Elspeth sexy?"
Byrne frowned.
"Hard to say. She could be with the right guy. To me, she seemed cold, but she never had eyes for anyone but Luke."
"Not that it matters. Luke is the faithful type. He'd stay with her if she was an iceberg, just out of a sense of duty." She paused. "There's something I have to say to you."
"Okay."
"Thank you for not saying I told you so. I sure appreciate your restraint."
Byrne laughed. "You're thinking about our great quarrel." She nodded.
"You said my work would be used to brainwash people. Now your prediction has come true."
"All the same, I was wrong. Your work had to be done. We need to understand the human brain. People may use knowledge to do evil, but we can't hold up scientific progress. But listen, do you have a theory about what Anthony is up to?"
"Best I could come up with. I imagine Luke discovered a spy down there at Cape Canaveral and came to Washington to tell the Pentagon about it. But the spy is really a double agent working for us, so Anthony is desperate to protect the guy."
Byrne shook his head. "Not good enough. Anthony could have dealt with that simply by telling Luke that the spy was a double. He didn't have to wipe his memory."
"I guess you're right. And Anthony shot at Luke a few hours ago. I know this secret agent work tends to go to men's heads, but I can't believe the CIA would actually kill an American citizen to protect a double agent."
"Sure they would," Byrne said. "But it wouldn't have been necessary. Anthony could just have trusted Luke."
"Do you have a better theory?"
"No."
Billy shrugged.
"I'm not sure it matters anymore. Anthony has deceived and betrayed his friends. Who cares why? Whatever strange purpose has driven him to this, we've lost him. And he was a good friend."
"Life sucks," Byrne said.
He kissed her cheek and got out of the car. "If you hear from Luke tomorrow, call me."
"Okay."
Byrne walked into the building and Billy drove off. She crossed the Memorial Bridge, skirted the National Cemetery, and zigzagged through the suburban streets to her home. She reversed into the driveway, a habit she had developed because she was usually in a hurry when leaving. She entered the house, hung her coat on the hall stand,
and went straight upstairs, unbuttoning her dress and pulling it off over her head as she did so. She threw it over a chair, kicked off her shoes, and went to check on Larry. When she saw the empty bed, she screamed. She looked in the bathroom, then Becky Ma's room. "Larry!" she yelled at the top of her voice. "Where are you?" She ran downstairs and went into every room. She left the house in her underwear and looked in the garage and the yard. Going back inside, she went into every room again, opening closets and checking under beds, looking into every space large enough to hold a 7-year-old. He was gone. Becky Ma came out of her bedroom, fear written on her lined face. "What's happening?" she said shakily. "Where's Larry?" Billy shouted. "In his bed, I thought," she said, her voice becoming a moan of misery as she realized what had happened. Billy stood still for a moment, breathing hard, fighting down panic. Then she went into Larry's bedroom and studied it. The room was tidy, with no signs of struggle. Checking his closet, she saw the blue teddy bear pajamas he had worn last night, neatly folded on a shelf. The clothes she had set out for school today had gone. Whatever had happened, he had got dressed before leaving. It looked as if he had gone with someone he trusted. Anthony. At first she felt relief. Anthony wouldn't harm Larry. But then she thought again. Wouldn't he? She would have said Anthony wouldn't harm Luke. But he had shot at him. There was no telling any more what Anthony would do. At the very least, Larry must have been frightened to be woken up so early and made to get dressed and leave the house without seeing his mother. She had to get him back fast. She ran downstairs to call Anthony. Before she got to the phone, it rang. She snatched it up. "Yes, this is Anthony." "How could you do it?" she screamed. "How could you be so cruel?" "I have to know where Luke is," he said coolly. "It's unimaginably important." "He's gone." She stopped herself. If she gave him the information, she would have no weapons left. "Gone where?" She took a breath. "Where's Larry?" "He's with me. He's fine. Don't worry." That enraged her. "How could I not worry, you dumb prick? Just tell me what I need to know, and everything will be all right." She wanted to believe him, to blurt out the answer and trust him to bring Larry home, but she resisted the temptation fiercely. "Listen to me. When I see my son, I'll tell you where Luke is." "Don't you trust me?" "Is that a joke?" He sighed. "Okay. Meet me at the Jefferson Memorial." She felt a small surge of triumph. "When?" 7 o'clock. She checked her watch. It was after 6. "I'll be there." "Billy."
"What?"
"Be alone."
"Yeah."
She hung up. Becky Ma was standing by her side, looking frail and old.
"What is it?" she said. "What's going on?"
Billy tried to give an impression of calm. "Larry's with Anthony. He must have come in and got him while you were asleep. I'm going to pick him up now. We can stop worrying." She went upstairs and threw on some clothes. Then she picked up the dressing table chair and placed it in front of the wardrobe. Standing on the chair, she took a small suitcase from on top of the wardrobe. She placed the case on the bed and opened it. She unwrapped a cloth to reveal a .45 Colt automatic. They had all been issued Colts in the war. She had kept hers as a souvenir, but some instinct made her clean and oil it regularly. Once you had been shot at, you were never comfortable unless you had a firearm someplace, she guessed. She pressed the thumb release on the left side of the grip, behind the trigger, and drew the magazine out of the handle. There was a box of bullets in the case. She loaded 7 into the magazine, pushing them in one by one against the spring, then slid the magazine back into the handle until she felt it lock. She worked the slide to chamber around. She turned around to see Becky Ma standing in the doorway staring at the gun. She looked back at her mother in silence for a moment. Then she ran out of the house and jumped into her car. 6:30 a.m. The first stage contains approximately 25,000 kilograms of fuel. This will be used up in 2 minutes and 35 seconds. Burns' Lincoln Continental was a joy to drive, a sleek, long-legged car that cruised at 100, effortlessly flying over the deserted roads of sleeping Virginia. In getting out of Washington, Luke felt he was leaving the nightmare behind, and his early hours' journey had the exhilarating air of an escape. It was still dark when he arrived at Newport News and pulled into the small parking lot next to the closed airport building. No lights showed except the solitary bulb of a phone booth next to the entrance. He turned off his engine and listened to the silence. The night was clear, and the airfield was starlit.
The parked planes seemed peculiarly still, like horses asleep on their feet. He had been up more than 24 hours, and he felt desperately weary, but his mind was racing. He was in love with Billy. Now that he was 200 miles away from her, he could admit that to himself. But what did it mean? Had he always loved her? Or was it a one-day infatuation, a repeat of the crush he had developed so quickly back in 1941? And what about Elspeth? Why had he married her? He had asked Billy that, and she had refused to answer. "I'll ask Elspeth," he had said. He checked his watch. He had more than an hour until takeoff. There was plenty of time. He got out of the car and went to the phone booth. She picked up fast, as if she was already awake. The hotel operator advised her that the phone charge would be added to her bill, and she said, "Sure, sure, put him on." Suddenly he felt awkward. "Good morning, Elspeth."
"I'm so glad you called," she said. "I've been out of my mind with worry. What's happening?"
"I don't know where to begin."
"Are you okay?"
"Yes, I'm fine now. Basically, Anthony caused me to lose my memory by giving me a combination of electric shock and drugs."
"Good God! Why would he do a thing like that?"
"He says I'm a Soviet spy."
"That's absurd."
"It's what he told Billy."
"So you've been with Billy?"
Luke heard the note of hostility in Elspeth's voice. "She's been kind," he said defensively. He recalled that he had asked Elspeth to come to Washington and help him, but she had refused. Elspeth changed the subject.
"Where are you calling from?"
He hesitated. His enemies might easily have tapped Elspeth's phone. "I don't really want to say in case someone is listening."
"All right, I understand. What are you going to do next?"
"I need to find out what it was that Anthony wanted me to forget."
"How will you do that?"
"I'd rather not say over the phone." Her voice betrayed exasperation.
"Well, I'm sorry you can't tell me anything.
Matter of fact, I called to ask you some things."
"Okay, fire away."
"Why can't we have children?"
"We don't know. Last year you went to a fertility specialist, but he couldn't find anything wrong. A few weeks ago I saw a woman doctor in Atlanta. She ran some tests. We're waiting for the results."
"Would you tell me how we came to get married?"
"I seduced you."
"How?"
"I pretended to have soap in my eye, in order to make you kiss me. It's the oldest trick in the book, and I'm embarrassed that you fell for it."
He couldn't tell whether she was being amusing, or cynical, or both. "Tell me what the circumstances were, how I proposed."
"Well, I didn't see you for years. Then we met again in 1954 in Washington," she began. "I was still with the CIA. You were working at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, but you flew in for Peg's wedding. We were seated together at the breakfast."
She paused, remembering, and he waited patiently. When she resumed, her voice had softened.
"We talked and talked. It was as if 13 years had never happened, and we were still a couple of college kids with all of life in front of us. I had to leave early. I was conductor of the 16th Street Youth Orchestra, and we had a rehearsal. You came with me."
1954. The children in the orchestra were all poor, and most of them were black. The rehearsal took place at a church hall in a slum neighborhood. The instruments were begged, borrowed, and bought from pawn shops. They were rehearsing the overture from a Mozart opera, The Marriage of Figaro. Against the odds, they played well. Elspeth was the reason. She was an exacting teacher, noticing every false note and rhythmic misstep, but she corrected her pupils with infinite patience. A tall figure in a yellow dress, she conducted the orchestra with enormous verve, her red hair flying, her long, elegant hands drawing the music from them with passionate gestures. The rehearsal lasted 2 hours, and Luke sat through the whole thing, mesmerized. He could see that all the boys were in love with Elspeth, and all the girls wanted to be like her. "These children have as much music in them as any rich kid with a Steinway in a drawing room," she said in the car afterwards. "But I get into lots of trouble."
"Why, for God's sake?"
"I'm called a nigger lover," she said, "and it's pretty much ended my career at the CIA.
"I don't understand."
"Anyone who treats Negroes like human beings is suspected of being a communist, so I'll never be more than a secretary. Not that it's a great loss. Women never get higher than case officer anyway."
She took him to her place, a small, uncluttered apartment with a few pieces of angular modern furniture. Luke made martinis, and Elspeth started to cook spaghetti in the tiny kitchen. Luke told her about his job. "I'm so happy for you," she said with generous enthusiasm. "You always wanted to explore outer space. Even back at Harvard when we were dating, you used to talk about it." He smiled. And in those days, most people thought it was a foolish dream of science fiction writers. "I guess we still can't be sure it'll happen."
"I think we can," he said seriously. "The big problems were all solved by German scientists in the war. The Germans built rockets that could be fired in Holland and land on London."
"I was there, I remember. We called them buzz bombs." She shuddered briefly. "One nearly killed me. I was walking to my office in the middle of an air raid because I had to brief an agent who was to be dropped into Belgium. A few hours later, I heard a bomb go off behind me. It makes a horrible noise, like crump. Then there's the sound of breaking glass and masonry collapsing, and a kind of wind full of dust and little bits of stone. I knew that if I turned around to look, I'd panic and throw myself to the ground and just curl up in a ball with my eyes shut. So I looked straight ahead and kept walking."
Luke was moved by the picture of the young Elspeth walking through the dark streets as the bombs fell around her, and he felt grateful that she had survived. "Brave woman," he murmured. She shrugged.
"I didn't feel brave, just scared."
"What did you think about?"
"Can't you guess?"
He recalled that whenever she was idle, she thought about math. "Prime numbers?" he hazarded. She laughed.
"Fibonacci's numbers."
Luke nodded. The mathematician Fibonacci had imagined a pair of rabbits which produced two offspring every month, offspring which began to breed at the same rate 1 month after birth, and asked how many pairs of rabbits there would be after a year. The answer was 144, but the number of pairs of rabbits each month was the most famous sequence of numbers in mathematics. 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. You could always work out the next number by adding up the previous two. Elspeth said, "By the time I got to my office, I had worked out the 40th Fibonacci number."
"Do you remember what it is?"
"Of course. 102,334,105. So, our missiles are based on the German buzz bombs?"
"Yes, their V-2 rocket, to be exact." Luke wasn't supposed to talk about his work, but this was Elspeth, and anyway, she probably had a higher security rating than he did. "We're building a rocket that can take off in Arizona and explode in Moscow, and if we can do that, we can fly to the moon."
"So it's just the same thing on a larger scale?"
She showed more interest in rocketry than any other girl he had ever met. "Yes, we need larger engines, more efficient fuel, better guidance systems, that kind of thing. None of these problems are insurmountable. Plus, those German scientists are working for us now."
"I think I heard that." She changed the subject. "And what about life in general? Are you dating someone?"
"Not right now." He had dated several girls since his breakup with Billy 9 years ago, and had slept with some of them, but the truth, which he didn't want to tell Elspeth, was that none had meant much. There had been one woman he might have loved, a tall girl with brown eyes and wild hair. She had the kind of energy and joie de vivre that he loved about Billy. He had met her at Harvard while he was doing his doctorate. Late one evening, as they strolled together through Harvard Yard, she had taken his hands and said, "I have a husband." Then she had kissed him and walked away. That was the nearest he had come to giving his heart.
"How about you?" he asked Elspeth.
"Peg's married, Billy's already getting divorced. You've got some catching up to do."
"Oh, you know about us government girls."
The phrase was a newspaper cliché. So many young women worked for the government in Washington that they outnumbered single men by 5 to 1. Consequently, they were stereotyped as sexually frustrated and desperate for dates. Luke didn't believe Elspeth was like that, but if she wanted to evade his question, she was entitled. She asked him to watch the stove while she freshened up. There was a big pan of spaghetti and a smaller one of bubbling tomato sauce. He took off his jacket and tie, then stirred the sauce with a wooden spoon. The martini had made him mellow, the food smelled good, and he was with a woman he really liked. He felt happy. He heard Elspeth call out, with an uncharacteristic note of helplessness, "Luke, could you come here?" He stepped into the bathroom.
Elspeth's dress hung on the back of the door, and she stood in a strapless, peach-colored brassiere and matching half-slip, stockings and shoes. Although she was wearing more clothes than if she had been on the beach, Luke found it unbearably sexy to see her in her underwear. Her hand was to her face. "I got soap in my eye, damn it," she said. "Would you try to wash it out?" Luke ran cold water into the wash basin. "Bend down, get your face close to the bowl," he said, encouraging her with his left hand between her shoulder blades. The pale skin of her back was soft and warm to his touch. He cupped water in his right hand and raised it to her eye. "That helps," she said. He rinsed her eye again and again until she said the stinging had stopped. Then he stood her upright and patted her face dry with a clean towel. "Your eye's a little bloodshot, but I guess it's okay," he said.
"I must look a mess."
"No." He looked hard at her. Her eye was red, and her hair on that side was wet in patches, but nevertheless, she was as stunning as she had been on the day he first set eyes on her more than a decade ago. "You're absolutely beautiful." Her head was still tilted up, though he had stopped drying her face. Her lips were parted in a smile. It was the easiest thing in the world to kiss her. She kissed him back, hesitantly at first. Then she put her hands behind his neck and pulled his face to hers and kissed him hard. Her bra pressed against his chest. It should have been sexy, but the wiring was so stiff that it scratched his chest through the fine cotton of his shirt. After a moment he pulled away, feeling foolish.
"What?" she said.
He lightly touched the brassiere and said with a grin, "It hurts."
"You poor thing," she said with mock pity.
She reached behind her back and unfastened the bra with a swift movement. It fell to the floor. He had touched her breasts a few times all those years ago, but he had never seen them. They were white and round, and the pale nipples were puckered with excitement. She put her arms around his neck and pressed her body to his. Her breasts were soft and warm.
"There," she said. "That's how it should feel."
After a while, he picked her up, stepped into the bedroom, and laid her on the bed. She kicked off her shoes. He touched the waistband of her half-slip and said, "May I?"
She giggled. "Oh, Luke, you're so polite."
He grinned. It was kind of silly, but he didn't know how else to be. She lifted her hips and he pulled off the slip. Her peach panties matched the rest of her underwear.
"Don't ask," she said. "Just take them off."
When they made love, it was slow and intense. She kept pulling his head to hers and kissing his face while he moved in and out of her.
"I've wanted this for so long," she whispered into his ear,
and then she cried out with pleasure several times and lay back, exhausted. Soon Elspeth fell into a deep sleep. But Luke lay awake, thinking about his life. He had always wanted a family. For him, happiness was a big, noisy house full of children and friends and pets. Yet here he was, 33 and single, and the years seemed to go by faster and faster. Since the war, his career had been his priority, he told himself. He had gone back to college, making up for the lost years, but that was not the real reason he was unmarried. The truth was that only two women had ever touched his heart, Billy and Elspeth. Billy had deceived him, but Elspeth was here beside him. He looked at her voluptuous body in the faint glow of the lights of DuPont Circle outside. Could there be anything better than spending every night like this with a girl who was smart, brave as a lion, wonderful with children, and, on top of all that, stunningly beautiful? At daybreak he got up and made coffee. He brought her into the bedroom on a tray and found Elspeth sitting up in bed looking sleepily delectable. She smiled happily at him. "I have something to ask you," he said. He sat on the edge of the bed and took her hand. "Will you marry me?" Her smile disappeared and she looked troubled.
"Oh, my God," she said. "Can I think about it?"
Seven a.m. The exhaust gases passed through the nozzle of the rocket like a cup of hot coffee being poured down the throat of a snowman. Anthony drove up to the Jefferson Memorial with Larry sitting in the front seat between him and Pete. It was still dark, and the area was deserted. He turned the car around and parked so that its headlights would shine at any other car that came along. The monument was a double circle of pillars with a domed roof. It stood on a high platform approached by steps at the rear. The statue is 19 feet high and weighs 10,000 pounds, he told Larry. It's made of bronze. Where is it? You can't see it from here, but it's inside those pillars.
We should have come in the daytime, Larry whined.
Anthony had taken Larry out before. They had gone to the White House and the zoo and the Smithsonian. They would get hot dogs for lunch and eat ice cream in the afternoon, and Anthony would buy Larry a toy before taking him home again. They always had a good time. Anthony was fond of his godson. But today Larry knew something was wrong. It was too early, and he wanted his mother, and he probably sensed the tension in the car. Anthony opened the door. "Stay here a second, Larry, while I talk to Pete," he said. The two men got out. Their breath misted in the cold air. Anthony said to Pete, "I'll wait here. You take the kid and show him the monument. Stay on this side so that she'll see him when she arrives." "Right," Pete's voice was cold and abrupt. "I hate this," Anthony said. In truth, he was past caring. Larry was unhappy, and Billy was frantic with fear, but they would get over it, and he wasn't going to allow sentiment to get in his way. "We're not going to harm the kid or his mother," he said, trying to reassure Pete. "But she'll tell us where Luke has gone."
"Then we give back the kid."
"No." "We don't?" Pete's expression was concealed by the darkness, but his voice betrayed dismay.
"Why not?"
"In case we need more information from her later." Pete was troubled, but he would acquiesce, at least for now, Anthony thought. He opened the car door.
"Come on, Larry. Uncle Pete's going to show you the statue."
Larry got out. With careful politeness, he said,
"After we've seen it, I think I'd like to go home."
Anthony's breath caught in his throat. Larry's bravery was almost too much. After a moment, Anthony replied in a calm voice,
"We'll check with Mommy. Now go ahead."
The child took Pete's hand, and they walked around the monument toward the steps at the back. A minute later, they appeared in front of the pillars, lit by the car's headlights. Anthony checked his watch. 16 hours from now, the rocket would have taken off, and it would all be over, one way or another. 16 hours was a lot, plenty of time for Luke to do unlimited damage. Anthony had to catch him, fast. Billy should be here by now. He suffered a pang of doubt. Surely she would come. She was too frightened and panicky to call the cops or pull any kind of stunt, he felt certain. He was right. A few moments later, another car arrived. Anthony couldn't see the color, but it was a Ford Thunderbird. It parked 20 yards from Anthony's Cadillac, and a small, slight figure jumped out, leaving the engine running.
"Hello, Billy," said Anthony.
She looked from him to the monument and saw Pete and Larry up on the raised platform looking into the circle. She stood frozen, staring. Anthony walked toward her.
"Don't try anything dramatic. It would upset Larry."
"Don't talk to me about upsetting him, you son of a bitch." Her voice cracked with strain. She was near to tears.
"I had to do this.
Nobody has to do something like this." Her hostility was hardly surprising, but all the same her contempt stung him. He said,
"Do you know the quote from Thomas Jefferson that appears inside this monument, in letters 2 feet high? It says, 'I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man.' That's why I'm doing it."
"The hell with your motives. You've lost sight of whatever ideals you once had. Nothing good can survive this kind of treachery." It was a waste of time arguing with her.
"Where's Luke?" he said abruptly.
There was a long pause. At last she said, "Luke caught a plane to Huntsville." Anthony breathed a deep sigh of satisfaction. He had what he needed. He was also surprised at the answer.
"Why Huntsville?"
"It's where the Army designs the rockets."
"I know that, but why would he go there today? Florida is where it's all happening."
"I don't know why." Anthony tried to read her face, but it was too dark.
"I think you're holding something back."
"I don't care what you think. I'm going to take my son and leave."
"No, you're not," Anthony said. "We're keeping him for a while."
Billy's voice was a cry of anguish. "Why? I've told you where Luke went."
"There may be other ways you can help us."
"It's not fair."
"You'll live," he turned away.
That was his mistake. Billy had been half expecting this. As he stepped toward his car, she rushed him. With her right shoulder, she hit him in the small of the back. She weighed only 120 pounds, and he had to be 50 pounds heavier, but she had surprise and rage on her side. He stumbled and fell forward, coming down on his hands and knees. He grunted with surprise and pain. Billy took the Colt from her coat pocket. As Anthony tried to get up, she charged him again, this time from the side. He crashed to the ground, rolling. As he came face up, she dropped to one knee beside his head and shoved the barrel of the gun forcefully into his mouth. She felt a tooth break. He froze. Deliberately, she moved the safety catch up to the firing position. She looked into his eyes and saw fear. He had not expected the gun. A trickle of blood appeared on his chin. Billy looked up. Larry and the man with him were still gazing at the monument, unaware of the fracas. She returned her attention to Anthony. "I'm going to take the gun out of your mouth," she said, panting. "If you move, I'll kill you. If you're still alive, you're going to call to your colleague and tell him what I say." She took the gun out of Anthony's mouth and pointed it at his left eye. "Now," she said, "call him." Anthony hesitated. She touched the barrel of the pistol to his eyelid. "Pete!" he shouted. Pete looked around. There was a pause. Pete said in a puzzled tone, "Where are you?" Anthony and Billy were outside the range of the headlights. Billy said, "Tell him to stay where he is." Anthony said nothing. Billy pressed the gun into his eye. Anthony shouted, "Stay where you are!" Pete put his hand to his forehead, peering into the dark, looking for the source of the voice. "What's happening?" he called. "I can't see you." Billy shouted, "Larry, this is Mom. Get in the T-Bird." Pete grabbed Larry's arm. "The man won't let me," Larry screamed. "Stay calm," Billy yelled. "Uncle Anthony's going to tell the man to let you go." She pressed the gun barrel harder into Anthony's eye. "All right," Anthony cried. She eased the pressure. He shouted, "Let the kid go." Pete said, "Are you sure? Do what I say, for Christ's sake. She's got a gun on me." "Okay," Pete released Larry's arm. Larry headed toward the back of the monument, then reappeared, seconds later, at ground level. He ran toward Billy. "Not this way," she said, struggling to keep her voice calm. "Get in the car, quickly." Larry ran to the Thunderbird and jumped in, slamming the door. With a quick, lashing movement, Billy hit Anthony on both sides of his face with the gun as hard as she could. He cried out in pain, but before he could move, she pushed the gun into his mouth again. He lay still, groaning. She said, "Remember that, if you're ever tempted to kidnap a child again." She stood up, withdrawing the gun from his mouth. "Stay still," she commanded. She backed toward her car, keeping the gun on him. She glanced up at the monument. Pete had not moved. She got into her car. Larry said, "Have you got a gun?" She stuffed the Colt inside her jacket. "Are you okay?" she asked him. He started to cry. She shoved the gear shift into first and tore away. 8 a.m. The smaller rockets, which power the second, third, and last stages, use a solid fuel known as T-17E2, a polysulfide with ammonium perchlorate as oxidizer. Each rocket generates about 1,600 pounds of thrust in space. Byrne poured warm milk over Larry's cornflakes while Billy beat up an egg for French toast. They were giving their child comfort food, but Billy felt the adults needed comfort too. Larry was eating heartily and listening to the radio at the same time. "I'm going to kill that son of a bitch, Anthony," Byrne muttered, speaking quietly so that Larry wouldn't hear. "I swear to God, I'll fucking kill him." Billy's rage had evaporated. Pistol-whipping Anthony had gotten rid of it all. Now she was worried and frightened, partly for Larry, who had had a nasty fright, and partly for Luke. "I'm afraid Anthony may try to kill Luke," she said. Byrne dropped a knob of butter into a hot frying pan, then dipped a slice of white bread into the egg mixture Billy had made. "Luke won't kill easy." "But he thinks he's escaped. He doesn't know I've told Anthony where he is." While Byrne fried the egg-soaked bread, Billy walked up and down the kitchen, biting her lip. "Anthony is probably on his way to Huntsville now. Luke's on a slow plane. Anthony could get a Matt's flight and be there first. I have to find a way to warn Luke." "Leave a message at the airport." "It's not reliable enough. I think I have to go there myself. There was a Viscount that left at 9, wasn't there? Where's that airline guide?"
"Right on the table."
Billy picked it up. Flight 271 left Washington at exactly 9. Unlike Luke's flight, this one stopped only twice, landing at Huntsville 4 minutes before noon. Luke's flight didn't land until 2:23. She could be waiting for him at the airport.
I can do it, she said.
Then you should. Billy hesitated, looking at Larry, torn by conflicting urges. Byrne read her mind. He'll be okay.
I know, but I don't want to leave him today of all days.
I'll take care of him.
Would you keep him out of school?
Yes, I think that'd be a good idea, at least for today, Larry said.
I finished my cornflakes,
Byrne said. Then you must be just about ready for some French toast. He slid a slice onto a plate. Want some maple syrup with that?
Yeah.
Yes, what?
Yes, please.
Byrne poured syrup from a bottle. Billy sat opposite her son and said,
I want you to skip school today.
But I'll miss swimming, he protested. Maybe Daddy will take you swimming.
But I'm not sick.
I know, honey, but you had kind of a tiring morning, and you need to rest. Larry's protests reassured Billy. He seemed to be recovering fast. All the same, she wouldn't be comfortable letting him go to school, not until this whole business was over. But she could leave him with his father. Byrne was a trained agent and could protect his kid from just about anything. She made a decision. She would go to Huntsville.
Have a fun day with Daddy, and maybe you'll go to school tomorrow, okay?
Okay.
Mommy has to go now.
She didn't want to make a drama of saying goodbye, for that would only scare the child.
I'll see you later, she said casually.
As she went out, she heard Byrne say, I bet you couldn't eat another slice of that French toast.
I could, too, Larry replied.
Billy closed the door.
Part 5. 10:45 a.m. The missile will take off vertically, then be tilted into a trajectory 40 degrees inclined to the horizon. The first stage is guided during powered flight by aerodynamic tail surfaces and by movable carbon vanes in the engine exhaust jet. Luke fell asleep as soon as he had fastened his seatbelt, and he was unaware of the takeoff from Newport News. He slept heavily while the plane was in the air, but woke up every time it bumped down at yet another airstrip on its stop-go flight west across Virginia and North Carolina. Each time his eyes opened, he felt a rush of anxiety and checked his watch to see how many hours and minutes were left until the launch. He would fidget in his seat while the little aircraft taxied across the apron. A few people would leave, one or two more would get on, and the plane would take off again. It was like riding the bus. The plane refueled at Winston-Salem, and the passengers got off for a few minutes. Luke called Redstone Arsenal from the terminal and got his secretary, Marigold Clark, on the phone.
Dr. Lucas, she said, are you okay?
I'm fine, but I only have a minute or two. Is the launch still scheduled for tonight?
Yes, 10:30.
I'm on my way to Huntsville. My plane lands at 2:23. I'm trying to figure out why I went there on Monday.
You still don't have your memory back?
No. Now, you don't know why I made that trip.
Like I said, you didn't tell me.
What did I do there?
Well, now, let me see. I met you at the airport in an army car and brought you here to the base. You went into the computation lab, then drove yourself down to the south end.
What's there, the south end?
The static test pads. I imagine you went into the engineering building. You sometimes work there, but I don't know for sure because I wasn't with you.
And then?
You asked me to drive you to your home.
Luke heard a prim note enter her voice.
I waited in the car while you stepped inside for a minute or two. Then I took you to the airport.
That's it?
That's all I know.
Luke grunted with frustration. He had felt sure Marigold would come up with some clue. Desperately, he cast about for another line of questioning. How did I look?
Okay, but your mind was someplace else. Preoccupied, that's the word I'm searching for. I figured you were worried about something. Happens all the time with you scientists. I don't let it trouble me.
Wearing my usual clothes?
One of them nice tweed jackets?
Carrying anything?
Just a little suitcase. Oh, and a file.
Luke stopped breathing for a moment.
A file? He said.
He swallowed. A stewardess interrupted him.
Time to board the aircraft, please, Dr. Lucas.
He covered the mouthpiece with his hand and said, Just 1 minute. Then he said to Marigold, Was it any special kind of file?
A standard army file folder, thin cardboard, buff-colored, large enough to hold business letters.
Any idea what was in it?
Just papers, it looked like.
Luke tried to breathe normally. How many sheets of paper? 1, 10, 100?
Maybe 15 or 20, I guess.
Did you happen to see what was on the sheets?
No, sir, you didn't take them out.
And did I still have this file when you took me to the airport? There was a silence at the other end. The stewardess returned. Dr. Lucas, if you won't board the plane, we'll have to go without you.
I'm coming, I'm coming. He began to repeat his question to Marigold. Did I still have the file?
I heard you, she interrupted. I'm trying to remember.
He bit his lip. Take your time.
Whether you had it at the house, I can't tell.
But at the airport?
You know, I don't believe you had it then. I'm picturing you walking away from me into the terminal, and I see you have your bag in one hand and in the other, nothing.
Are you sure?
Yes, now I am. You must have left that file here somewhere, either at the base or at home.
Luke's mind was racing. The file was the reason for his trip to Huntsville, he felt sure. It contained the secret he had found out, the one that Anthony was so desperate for him to forget. Maybe it was a Xerox copy of the original, and he had stashed it somewhere for safekeeping. That was why he had asked Marigold not to tell anyone of his visit. It seemed ultra-cautious, but no doubt he had learned such habits in the war. Now, if he could find the file, he could discover the secret. The stewardess had abandoned him, and he saw her running across the tarmac. The plane's propellers were already turning.
I think that file could be very important, he told Marigold. Could you look around and see if it's there? My lord, Dr. Lucas, this is the army. Don't you know there must be a million of them buff-colored file folders here? How would I know which is the one you were carrying?
Just check around. See if there's one someplace where it shouldn't be. As soon as I land at Huntsville, I'll go to the house and search there. Then, if I don't find it, I'll come to the base. Luke hung up and ran for the plane.
11 a.m. The flight plan is programmed in advance. During flight, signals telemetered to the computer activate the guidance system to keep it on course. The Matt's flight to Huntsville was full of generals. Redstone Arsenal did more than design space rockets. It was the headquarters of the Army Ordnance Missile Command. Anthony, who kept track of this kind of thing, knew that a whole range of weapons was being developed and tested at the base, from the baseball bat-sized Red Eye for ground troops to use against enemy aircraft, up to the huge surface-to-surface Honest John. The base undoubtedly saw a lot of brass. Anthony wore sunglasses to conceal the two black eyes Billy had given him. His lip had stopped bleeding, and a broken tooth showed only when he talked. Despite his injuries, he felt energized. Luke was within his grasp. Should he simply take the first opportunity to kill him? It was temptingly simple, but he worried that he didn't know exactly what Luke was up to. He had to make a decision. However, by the time he boarded the plane, he had been awake for 48 hours straight, and he fell asleep. He dreamed he was 21 again, and there were new leaves on the tall trees in Harvard Yard, and a life full of glorious possibilities stretched before him like an open road. Next thing he knew, Pete was shaking him as a corporal opened the aircraft door, and he woke up inhaling a warm Alabama breeze. Huntsville had a civilian airport, but this was not it. Matt's flights came down on the airstrip within Redstone Arsenal. The terminal building was a small wooden hut, the tower an open steel gantry with a one-room flight control post on top. Anthony shook his head to clear it as he walked across the parched grass. He was carrying the small bag which held his gun, a false passport, and $5,000 in cash, the emergency kit without which he never caught a plane. Adrenaline enlivened him. In the next few hours he would kill a man for the first time since the war. His stomach tensed as he thought of it. Where would he do it? One option was to wait for Luke at the Huntsville airport, follow him as he left, and gun him down on the road somewhere. But that was high risk. Luke might well spot the tail and escape. He would never be an easy target. He could yet slip away if Anthony was not extremely careful. It might be best to find out where Luke was planning to go, then get there ahead and ambush him. I'm going to make some inquiries at the base, he said to Pete. I want you to go to the airport and keep watch. If Luke arrives or anything else happens, try to reach me here. At the edge of the airstrip, a young man in the uniform of a lieutenant waited with a card that read, Mr. Carroll, State Department. Anthony shook his hand. Colonel Hickam's compliments, sir, the lieutenant said formally. As requested by the State Department, we have provided you with a car. He pointed to an olive drab Ford. That'll be fine, Anthony said. He had called the base before catching his plane, brazenly pretending he was under orders from CIA Director Alan Dulles, and demanded Army cooperation for a vital mission, the details of which were classified. It had worked. This lieutenant seemed eager to please.
Colonel Hickam would be glad if you would drop by headquarters at your convenience. The lieutenant handed Anthony a map. The base was enormous, Anthony realized. It stretched several miles south, all the way to the Tennessee River. The headquarters building is marked on the map, the soldier went on, and we have a message asking you to call Mr. Carl Hobart in Washington.
Thank you, Lieutenant. Where's Dr. Claude Lucas's office?
That'll be the computation laboratory. He took out a pencil and made a mark on the map. But all those guys are down to Cape Canaveral this week.
Does Dr. Lucas have a secretary?
Yes, Mrs. Marigold Clark.
She might know Luke's movements.
Good. Lieutenant, this is my colleague Pete Maxwell. He needs to get to the civilian airport to meet a flight.
I'd be glad to drive him there, sir.
I appreciate that. If he needs to reach me here at the base, what's the best way?
The lieutenant looked at Pete. Sir, you could always leave a message at Colonel Hickam's office, and I would try to get it to Mr. Carroll.
Good enough, Anthony said decisively. Let's get going.
He got into the Ford, checked the map, and started out. It was a typical Army base. Arrow straight roads ran through rough woodland broken by neat rectangles of lawn close-cropped like a conscript's haircut. The buildings were all flat-roofed structures of tan brick. It was well signposted, and he easily found the computation lab, a T-shaped building 2 stories high. Anthony wondered why they needed so much space to make calculations, then realized they must have a powerful computer in there. He parked outside and thought for a few moments. He had a simple question to ask. Where in Huntsville did Luke plan to go? Marigold probably knew, but she would be defensive of Luke and wary of a stranger, especially one with 2 black eyes. However, she had been left behind here when most of the people she worked with had gone to Cape Canaveral for the big event, so she was probably also feeling lonely and bored. He went into the building. In an outer office were 3 small desks, each with a typewriter. 2 were vacant. The 3rd was occupied by a Negro woman of about 50, wearing a flowered cotton dress printed with daisies and spectacles with diamante rims. "Good afternoon," he said. She looked up. He took off his sunglasses. Her eyes widened in surprise at his appearance.
"Hello, how can I help you?"
With mock sincerity, he said, "Ma'am, I'm looking for a wife who won't beat me up." Marigold burst out laughing. Anthony pulled up a chair and sat to one side of her desk. "I'm from Colonel Hickam's office," he said. "I'm looking for Marigold Clark. Where is she?"
"That's me."
"Oh, no, the Miss Clark I'm looking for is a grown woman. You're just a young girl."
"Now you stop your jive," she said, but she smiled broadly.
"Dr. Lucas is on his way here. I guess you knew that."
"He called me this morning."
"What time do you expect him?"
"His plane lands at 2:23.
That was useful. "So he'll be here around 3.
"Not necessarily."
"Ah. Why not?" She gave him what he wanted.
"Dr. Lucas said he's going home first, then he'll stop by here."
That was perfect. Anthony could hardly believe his luck. Luke was going from the airport straight to his house. Anthony could go there and wait, then shoot Luke as soon as he walked in the door. There would be no witnesses. If he used the silencer, no one would even hear a shot. Anthony would leave the body where it fell and drive away. With Elspeth in Florida, the corpse might not be found for days. "Thank you," he said to Marigold. He stood up. "It was a pleasure to meet you." He left the room before she could ask his name. He returned to the car and drove to the headquarters building, a long 3-story monolith that looked like a prison. He found Colonel Hickam's office. The colonel was out, but a sergeant showed him to an empty room with a phone. He called Q Building, but did not speak to his boss, Carl Hobart. Instead, he asked for Carl's superior, George Cooperman.
"What's up, George?" he said.
"Did you shoot at someone last night?"
said Cooperman, his smoker's voice sounding even more gravelly than usual. With an effort, Anthony put on the swashbuckling persona that appealed to Cooperman.
"Ah, hell, who told you that?"
"Some colonel from the Pentagon called Tom Healy in the director's office, and Healy told Carl Hobart, who had an orgasm."
"There's no proof. I picked up all the slugs."
"This colonel found a hole in the fucking wall about 9 millimeters wide, and he guessed what caused it. Did you hit anybody?"
"Unfortunately not."
"You're in Huntsville now, right?"
"Yeah."
"You're supposed to come back immediately."
"Then it's a good thing I didn't talk to you."
"Listen, Anthony, I always cut you as much slack as I can because you get results. But I can't do any more for you on this one. You're on your own from here, buddy. That's how I like it. Good luck.
Anthony hung up and sat staring at the phone. He didn't have much more time. His Billy the Kid act was wearing thin. He could disobey orders for only so long. He needed to wrap this up fast. He called Cape Canaveral and got Elspeth on the phone. "Have you talked to Luke?" he asked her.
"He called me at 6:30 this morning." She sounded shaky.
"Where from?" He wouldn't say where he was, where he was going, or what he intended to do because he was afraid my phone might be tapped. But he told me you were responsible for his amnesia.
"He's on his way to Huntsville. I'm at Redstone Arsenal now. I'm going to your house to wait for him there. Will I be able to get in?"
She answered with another question. "Are you still trying to protect him?"
"Of course."
"Will he be okay?"
"All I can do is my best."
There was a moment's pause, then she said,
"There's a key under the bougainvillea pot in the backyard."
"Thanks."
"Take care of Luke, won't you?"
"I said I would do my best."
"Don't snap at me," she said, with some of her more usual spirit.
"I'll take care of him."
He hung up. He stood up to go, and the phone rang. He wondered whether to answer. It might be Hobart, but Hobart did not know he was in Colonel Hickam's office. Only Pete knew that, he thought. He picked up. It was Pete.
"Dr. Josephson's here," he said.
Shit! Anthony had felt sure she was out of the picture.
"She just got off a plane?"
"Yeah, it must have been a faster flight than the one Lucas is on. She's sitting in the terminal building like she's waiting."
"For him," Anthony said decisively. "Damn her, she's come to warn him that we're here. You have to get her out of there."
"How?"
"I don't care. Just get rid of her."
12 noon. The Explorer's orbit will be at 34 degrees to the equator. Relative to the Earth's surface, it will head southeast across the Atlantic Ocean to the southern tip of Africa, then northeast across the Indian Ocean and Indonesia to the Pacific.
Huntsville Airport was small but busy. The single terminal building had a Hertz desk, some vending machines, and a row of phone booths. As soon as she arrived, Billy checked on Luke's flight and learned it was running almost an hour late and would land in Huntsville at 3:15. She had 3 hours to kill. She got a candy bar and a Dr. Pepper from a machine. She put down the attaché case that contained her Colt and stood leaning against a wall, thinking. How was she going to handle this? As soon as she saw Luke, she would warn him that Anthony was here. Luke would be on his guard and could take precautions, but he couldn't go into hiding. He had to find out what he had done here on Monday, and for that he would need to move around. He had to take risks. Could she do anything to help protect him? As she was racking her brains, a girl in Capital Airlines uniform approached her.
"Are you Dr. Josephson?"
"Yes."
"I have a phone message for you."
She handed over an envelope. Billy frowned. Who knew she was here?
"Thanks," she muttered, tearing it open.
"You're very welcome. Please let us know if there's any way we can be of further service." Billy looked up and smiled. She had forgotten how polite people were in the South.
"I sure will," she said. "I appreciate that."
The girl walked away, and Billy read her message. "Please call Dr. Lucas at Huntsville, JE64231. She was bewildered. Could Luke be here already? And how had he known she would be here? There was only one way to find out. She dropped her pop bottle in a trash can and found a payphone. The number she dialed answered immediately, and a man's voice said, "Components test lab." It sounded as if Luke was already at Redstone Arsenal. How had he done that trick? She said,
"Dr. Claude Lucas, please."
"Just one moment."
After a pause, the man came back.
"Dr. Lucas stepped out for a minute. Who is this, please?"
"Dr. Bilha Josephson, I have a message to call him on this number."
The man's tone changed immediately.
"Oh, Dr. Josephson, I'm so glad we found you. Dr. Lucas is very concerned to contact you."
"What's he doing here? I thought he was still in the air.
Army security pulled him off the plane at Norfolk, Virginia, and laid on a special flight. He's been here more than an hour."
She felt relieved he was safe, but at the same time she was puzzled.
"What's he doing there?"
"I think you know."
"Okay, I guess I do. How's it going?"
"Fine, but I can't give you details, especially over the phone. Can you get yourself down to us?"
"Where are you?"
"The lab is about an hour out of town on the Chattanooga Road. I could send an army driver to pick you up, but it would be quicker for you to get a cab or rent a car."
Billy took a notebook out of her bag. "Give me directions." Then, remembering her southern manners, she added,
"If you would, please."
This ends Disc 7. Code 20, Disk 8.
1 p.m. The first stage engine must be switched off sharply and separated immediately, otherwise gradual thrust decay could cause the first stage to catch up with the second and misalign it. As soon as pressure drops in the fuel lines, the valves are closed, and the first stage is separated 5 seconds later by detonation of spring-loaded explosive bolts. The springs increase the speed of the second stage by 2.6 feet per second, ensuring that it separates cleanly. Anthony knew the way to Luke's house. He had spent a weekend there a couple of years back, soon after Luke and Elspeth had moved from Pasadena. He reached the place in 15 minutes. It was on Eccles Hill, a street of large older homes a couple of blocks from downtown. Anthony parked around the corner so that Luke would not be forewarned that he had a visitor. He walked back to the house. He should have felt quietly confident. He held all the cards, surprise, time, and a gun. But instead he was nauseated with apprehension. Twice already he had felt he had Luke in his hands, and Luke had eluded him. He still didn't know why Luke had chosen to fly to Huntsville rather than Cape Canaveral. This inexplicable decision suggested there was something Anthony didn't know about, an unpleasant surprise that might leap out at him any moment. The house was a white, turn-of-the-century colonial with a pillared veranda. It was too grand for an army scientist, but Luke had never pretended to live on what he made as a mathematician. Anthony opened a gate in a low wall and entered the yard. The place would have been easy to break into, but that would not be necessary. He circled around to the back. By the kitchen door was a terracotta planter with bougainvillea spilling out of it, and under the pot was a big iron key. Anthony let himself in. The outside was pleasantly old-fashioned, but the interior was right up to the minute. Elspeth had every kind of gadget in the kitchen. There was a big hall decorated in bright pastel colors, a living room with a console TV and a record player, and a dining room with modern splayed-leg chairs and sideboards. Anthony preferred traditional furniture, but he had to admit this was stylish. As he stood in the living room, staring at a curved couch upholstered in pink vinyl, he recalled vividly the weekend he had spent here. He had known within an hour that the marriage was in trouble. Elspeth was flirtatious, always a sign of tension with her, and Luke adopted a forced air of cheery hospitality that was quite uncharacteristic. They had given a cocktail party on the Saturday night and invited the young crowd from Redstone Arsenal. This room had been full of badly dressed scientists talking about rockets, junior officers discussing their prospects for promotion, and pretty women gossiping about the intrigues of life at a military base. The gramophone had been stacked with long-playing jazz records, but that night the music had sounded plaintive, not joyous. Luke and Elspeth had got drunk, a rare thing for both of them, and Elspeth had grown more flirty while Luke became quieter and quieter. Anthony had found it painful to see two people he liked and admired so unhappy, and the whole weekend had depressed him. And now the long drama of their interwoven lives was playing out its inevitable conclusion. Anthony decided to search the house. He didn't know what he was looking for, but he might turn up something that would give him a clue to why Luke was coming here and warn him of unforeseen danger. He put on a pair of rubber gloves he found in the kitchen. There would be a murder investigation eventually, and he didn't want to leave fingerprints. He started in the study, a small room lined with shelves of scientific books. He sat at Luke's desk, which looked out onto the backyard, and opened the drawers. Over the next 2 hours, he searched the house from top to bottom. He found nothing. He looked in every pocket of every suit in Luke's well-filled closet. He opened every book in the study to check for papers concealed between the pages. He took the lids off every piece of Tupperware in the enormous double-door refrigerator. He went into the garage and searched the handsome black Chrysler 300C, the fastest stock sedan in the world, according to the newspapers, from its streamlined headlamps to its rocket ship tail fins. He learned a few intimate secrets along the way. Elspeth colored her hair, used sleeping pills which were prescribed by a doctor, and suffered from constipation. Luke used a dandruff shampoo and subscribed to Playboy magazine. There was a small pile of mail on a table in the hall, put there by the maid, presumably. Anthony shuffled the letters, but there was nothing of interest. A flyer from a supermarket, Newsweek, a postcard from Ron and Monica in Hawaii, envelope.